And I remember getting so angry with my GP. It was absolutely a phenomenal GP. And I justified that with anger to say, well, if he's not going to give me the drugs, I have to do heroin every day. And my heroin use had gone to once a week to probably two or three times a week. I was actually addicted, physically addicted at this stage, but I hadn't mentally given into the fact that I was addicted. And that for me was the time where I have to do it every day. To cope was the only way.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today describes his life as a second chance, not just to survive, but to truly live. Dr. Brian Penny is many things, a neuroscientist, author and lecturer, but before all that, he was a heroin addict lost in addiction for over 15 years. Since getting clean in 2013, Brian has devoted his life to understanding the mind and helping others to transform theirs. This conversation will touch on addiction, trauma, mental health and recovery. And if you're affected by any of the topics discussed, you'll find links to support services in our show notes. This conversation will also demonstrate the enduring hope that comes with recovery from addiction. Dr. Brian Penny, welcome to the Insights podcast. A neuroscientist who was addicted to heroin for 15 years. There are not many people who could have that on their CV.
No, it's an interesting story. I always find it fascinating listening to the comparison of the before and after, but it's been quite the journey. But as you mentioned there as well, it's not about surviving, it's about thriving, you know, that way. And that's where I'm just trying to optimize life and really, really live.
Tell me a bit about your background, Brian, your family, where you grew up, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I grew up in an area in West Dublin, challenging area, really challenging area. My mum and dad be working class and stuff like that as well. And I suppose a lot of violence in the area where I grew up, not in the family household. Now, I had a very loving family. We didn't have affection. We didn't do affection in our family, but I felt loved through service and stuff like that, I suppose. But alcoholism in the family as well. My mum and dad were both alcoholics. And I suppose the area where we grew up, it was very normalised to see alcohol issues, drug issues, crime, robbed cars. And what I've since learned is that would have been very challenging for the nervous system. And building on a previous experience I had as well, as an infant, I actually had an operation without a general anaesthetic, a very invasive operation.
And you weren't just a child, you were an infant.
Infant.
You were barely, a month old?
Yeah, 3 weeks old. And it's quite shocking for people to hear that. But before 1985, infants were not given a general anaesthetic when they were going under the knife for surgery. The medical practice believed that infants didn't experience pain the same as adults and they're not going to remember it anyway. But we know today that that is very, very wrong, and infants actually experience pain to a greater level.
You had what's described as an intestinal malrotation as an infant, and obviously that required surgery. You believe a lot of the difficulties that you encountered in life subsequently stemmed from that.
Yeah, it was one of many traumas. And since writing my book and speaking to experts on trauma, there was multiple traumas in my life, but it's a compounding factor. So literally what trauma does, like, it rewires your brain and your body, leaving you hypervigilant. It's actually an adaptive process, sort of keeping you on red alert to avoid future threats. But anyone that's really sensitive and really hypervigilant and struggles with anxiety, there's probably been some pain in their life, maybe trauma that's appeared in their life previously. And that's where I was. So I was always worried, always agitated, afraid of my own inner body. And then with my mum and dad being alcoholics, I was very, very aware of that and worrisome about that.
What role did school play in your life growing up? Was it important to you? Were you a good student?
Yeah, I was a very good student, I have to be honest. Yeah, I was really good in school. I was always looking for validation. Like, I'd be very competitive today. I was very competitive back then. And I loved getting the gold star in my forehead, stuff like that. Like, so I really tried. I worked hard to get that validation off my parents and off the teachers. And to be honest, like, I always felt confident. I always had great self-belief that I was going to go on and have a good life. I was going to be successful in life, despite the area where I grew up. Like, we lived in a bubble where people didn't go to college, but I thought I could break through that. So I had good memories around that. But what always held me back was the anxiety and the panic that I felt. And I was talking to Dr. Gabor Mate. He is the world's leading expert in trauma and addiction, in my opinion and many people's opinions. And he had actually read my book when we were doing a bit of work together. And what he said to me was, my greatest trauma, he says, you're aware of the trauma as an infant, the operation that you had. You're aware of your mum and dad's drinking. But he says, who did you share your anxiety and your challenges with? And I says, no one. And he says, that's your real trauma. You didn't share that. You were alone, disconnected, afraid. Whereas a human, you should be feeling warmth, belonging, as if you can share your feelings. He says, then heroin came along and drugs came along and gave you that sense of warmth. He says, that's your real trauma, that I was so lonely and disconnected. So lots of different elements sort of compounded over time.
How did you get into drugs?
I suppose the area where I grew up, it was inevitable in a certain way. Like, there was a lot of people in addiction around the place. I never thought I would be an addict in inverted commas, but we tried petrol. We started sniffing petrol in the fields, and it was just everyone kind of done it, you know, taking tablets, drinking alcohol. But funnily enough, we were big into Jim Morrison and the Doors. Really big into Jim Morrison and the Doors. We used to have every Friday night smoking hash sitting around the table in my friend's house, a gang of us. And Jim had this idea that you should try everything once. So he says, okay, Jim, we'll try heroin once. And a gang of us tried heroin for the first time. But only two
age?
Of us, age 16. 16 years of age, and only two of us became addicted. But again, touching on what you were saying, I didn't believe I could be an addict. I thought I'm beyond that, I'm better than that. Like, that's the belief I had at the time. But it hooked me in the very first moment. I wasn't addicted immediately, but it hooked me in because it gave me that sense of warmth, that sense of peace. I describe it like a warm blanket just wrapped around me, and it had me mentally in its clutches from that first moment.
And at that stage, I mean, your life really was, and your general disposition and feeling was one of constant anxiety, was it?
Yeah, constant anxiety, agitation, that no one is, worrying. I was always up in my head, worrying about my mum and dad aren't going to get home, worrying about death and everyone around me, that somebody was going to die. That was a constant fear in my life.
Did you know many people who died young?
Yeah, God, the area where we grew up, I'd say 20, 25 people before 21 years of age. Yeah.
But with heroin and you, it was love at first sight.
It was love at first sight, yeah. It really was. It was a strange kind of relationship because I thought I was smarter than heroin, and I thought I had the secret that you could do heroin once a week and not become addicted. Justification, rationalising my use. But I loved it. And looking back, it was only a matter of time before it really pulled me in.
Where did you get it from?
That was the funny thing, because we had this idea that we weren't going to be real addicts. Like, we weren't heroin addicts. We sort of thought, no, I'm a bit better than that. Like, that's the belief I had in my head. So we got it on the sly because we didn't want anyone. Like, the language back then was, you'd hear people saying, and I hate the word, but he says, he's only a junkie. So there was no way was I going to be a junkie or going towards that. So we got it off a friend of a friend on the sly, and I found it actually quite difficult to get at the start. Like, I could have gotten it easily with anyone knowing about it, but to get it without anyone knowing about it was quite difficult. So sometimes it would take us like a couple of days to get it and stuff like that, but it was always through a friend of a friend. But then I got to the stage where I just didn't really care who knew, I just needed it.
So that started when you were about 16 or thereabouts. So meanwhile, what was going on at school? I mean, had you done the junior cert or did you do the leaving cert? What kind of exam results were you getting?
Yeah, I was getting good exam results. It's funny, it's probably not good by today's standards. You hear everyone getting 600 points, but I got around 380 points in the leaving, the old leaving cert. So it was like good results. I wanted to go to art college. I was quite good at art. But I remember I was dabbling with heroin doing my leaving cert. That was the start of it, doing my actual leaving cert. So I went to art college for 6 months, and I think addiction was really getting its claws inside of me, and I left after 6 months to sell coal, of all things. My dad was a coal man, so he was giving up the coal runs. Me and my best mate were selling coal around the street, and it was to get money to buy hash, to buy drugs. And I started having panic attacks around then as well. And I got a job working in the graphics industry, ironically for Big Pharma. So at one stage, I used to design methadone and anti-anxiety medication, an ironic part of my journey. But I had a panic attack in the workplace that was so powerful, it changed my baseline anxiety from, let's say, 20, 30% to 80 or 90%. And I remember just thinking, I can't live this way. And I went to the doctor and he gave me benzodiazepine, Valium and Xanax to cope with that. And I went back a week later and saying, these are great, I need more. And he says, no, that's a short-term solution. You need to work on yourself. And he gave me a book. And I remember getting so angry with my GP. It was absolutely a phenomenal GP. And I justified that with anger to say, well, if he's not going to give me the drugs, I have to do heroin every day. And my heroin use had gone to once a week to probably two or three times a week. I was actually addicted, physically addicted at this stage, but I hadn't mentally given into the fact that I was addicted. And that for me was the time where I have to do it every day. To cope was the only way.
How were you taking it?
I was smoking. I was smoked heroin all my life up until the end. I had a phobic fear of needles because of the trauma that I experienced. So I could never put a needle into my arm. But near the end, heroin was doing nothing for me. So I did get there in the latter stages.
You described yourself as having been a functioning addict.
Yeah.
You're able to show up for work every day.
Yeah, I call myself functional to an extent. Like near the latter stages, like when addiction really took hold, I could barely stay awake. The basic prerequisite for working. But I was really good at my job. It was in the graphics industry and I was quite technical in the job. So that kind of enabled me. And a lot of enabling going on as well. Like I had great friends in the workplace. So they'd protect me that if I was a bit stoned, they'd make sure I wasn't seen by management. If the quality control customers would come in, they'd hide me in a different room. So enabling through caring for me kept me longer in addiction.
Did any of them ever talk to you about your situation?
Yeah, they did. Like my boss was from, she was from Temple Oak, like well-to-do, and she didn't know the ins and outs of addiction, but I was on methadone for most of these years. So she'd often ask me, oh, Brian, you're looking a bit rough. Did you drink your green stuff? So she knew that this was going on. She actually tried to move me into her house to try to break free from addiction at some stage. Like there was a lot of love, a lot of care within that. But there's nothing anyone can do or nothing anyone can say. And it was only going in one direction.
In the TV documentary, the three-part series that you made recently for RT1 called Hooked, you talked about, at the very start, about, you know, maybe going through a bottle of vodka, four bags of heroin, 100 mils of methadone, 20 Valium, in a day.
In a day.
Not every day, surely.
Yeah, every day. If I could get those drugs every day, like heroin would be... I would get, like, sometimes it could be six bags of heroin. It's called a queue of heroin. But, like, if I had €200 for it, I would get a much bigger bag, which would be the equivalent of 20 bags. But it would do nothing for me. Because I was smoking it would do nothing for me. It was the benzos and the alcohol and sleeping tablets, because you can take a lot of them, especially those tablets. Like I was taking sometimes 7 or 8 sleeping tablets in the morning when I woke up to function. That's how messed up my biology was. It was just so messed up. And the tolerance levels, like you build up this tolerance where you're just getting nothing off the drugs. So I was trying to combine different drugs in a scientific way just to give me some kind of relief from what I was feeling. But my tolerance levels went so high. And I've later learned through neuroscience and through research and stuff like that, that a lot of stuff wasn't even going into my system. It was getting flushed out through the liver. So there's only so much that will actually get into the bloodstream. So I was wasting a lot of it.
I'm wondering how you paid for all that.
I had a heroin habit of, it was at its worst, it was about €150 a day. So the only way I could fund that habit, like I had a good job, like back then I was on about 50 grand a year. I was on shift and I was on about 50 grand a year. Everything went on drugs, everything. I was also able to get credit cards, credit union loans. Like when I broke free from addiction, or when I nearly died from addiction, you could say, I was in €50,000 worth of debt, all to pay for drugs. And I also sold drugs to fund my drug habit.
You were a dealer. Started when?
That started, God, I started selling drugs. I'll never forget, like, I don't want to justify this, but I remember thinking I had an entrepreneurial spirit. And I remember at the age of about, when we were about 17 and 18, we were going and buying, we start smoking hash and we were going and buying, it was called 10 spots at the time. So we'd go and buy 10 spots. There'd be 10 of us and we'd all have a tenner each, 10 spots. And I found out that we could get double the amount if we bought the lump and cut it out amongst ourselves. So that's what I started doing, and getting a bigger lump for myself. So you could sell in amongst friends, I suppose. And I always really sold amongst friends. Like I think there's this sort of preconceived idea. I often hear people saying that you can hear a drug dealer's going out and trying to sell it to kids and give it to people, that don't do drugs. I've never witnessed that in my life. It's usually through your circles and the people that want drugs. And I usually sold through my friends. And I remember saying at one stage, I would never sell heroin. Only scumbags sell heroin. I would never do this. Only scumbags do that. And as the years went by, I found myself doing the thing I thought only scumbags would do. So for me, it was like selling cocaine to my friends to fund my heroin habit. But it was all just to get money to fund my own addiction. And that's for a lot of people that are selling drugs.
So that typical day that began with taking, you said, about 7 sleeping tablets. I mean, take it from when you got out of bed in the morning. I mean, people might say, well, surely he would have been taking the 7 sleeping tablets at night. But
no, I'd wake up in the morning. I'd do 60 to 100 mils of methadone, whatever I was being prescribed at the time. I'd probably do half a bag of heroin, a couple of sleeping tablets, Valium. The problem is as well, there's a dance that's going on. I went on a Thursday to give a urine so I could get a script for me methadone. If I had a dirty urine, I wouldn't. They'd be threatening to take me methadone off me, or I'd have to go every day and drink it in the chemist. So I wouldn't do benzodiazepine at a certain amount of time. The sleeping tablets were called Zoplicon. They didn't come up in the urine. So you're constantly doing this play. Vodka became a thing because that didn't come up in the urine either. So it's a dance of trying to get your methadone, not have dirty urine, sometimes buying clean urine. The hustle just to get your drugs, which is just to relieve the pain and anxiety you're going through. Like it's such a tough life.
Eventually, you ran out of road with your employer.
Yeah, I can laugh now because of how it's turned out. But like my two really good friends in the workplace, I won't say their names, but they were really, really good friends. And they inherited me as a problem from my previous boss, who was phenomenal as well. And I was just running out of road, as you say. And we merged with another company. And when the other company came into this open plan office, they were like, what the hell is going on with this fella? Like, how is he work here? What's going on? Like, and it got to the stage where rumours got back and people were telling that I needed to get sacked. And I remember getting called into a meeting with the union representatives, who were my two best friends in the workplace, the factory manager and the general manager of the company. And I went in to the meeting, and after the meeting I came out and I says to my best friend in the job, he was the shop steward at the time, it's called, I says, I think that went all right, did it? And he looked at me with his jaw on the floor. He says, Brian, you think it went all right? You fell asleep. Your head landed on the table and we were all just looking at each other. So I literally fell asleep, goofed off, as they call it, on drugs in the meeting to save my job. And for me, that was nearly the end of the end. Like, I was going to get sacked. I was losing the job. The union says, do not go back into the workplace because they will just sack you on the spot. So that sort of forced me, because I was in so much debt to pay the drugs. I had no way. Nobody would trust me to sell drugs anymore. So I had no way of getting money. The road had run out in many different ways. So that sort of forced me to seek professional help, to go into a treatment centre, a detox centre, to get off drugs. And that was really the start of the end of my addiction and the start of my new life.
Had you been living at home with your parents, with your family all this time?
No, I lived with my mum and dad until I was about 29. And then there was an incident, let's say, I won't go into the details of it, but there was an incident where the cars got burnt in the front garden, and I didn't realise at the time, but my mum orchestrated a move for us to get out. Now, she's amazing. She got us to save money up, especially my two brothers, and we got a house on the affordable housing scheme. My older brother sort of got that. So I was living with them, me and my two brothers, for a certain amount of time, and they had addiction issues as well. So that was a real challenge as well, because they didn't have heroin issues, but drinking, cocaine, weeds, all of that. So it was a toxic house.
So when things came to that crisis point with your employer, you decided, I better do something about this. So how difficult was it, or was it easy or fairly straightforward for you to get into treatment?
I had no idea. I had never tried to get clean before. I fundamentally believed I can't cope with anxiety. I need drugs to survive in this world. That was my fundamental narrative and view of the world. But now I'd no choice. I was like a rat trapped in a corner. And I says, right. And I remember believing, right, I'm going to try to go into a detox, but when I come back out, I'll just do it better, smarter, not as many drugs, and do it smarter, because I didn't think I could live without it. So when I tried to get into a detox facility, I thought treatment detox, I didn't know the language of it at the time, but they told me, because I was taking so many benzodiazepine and sleeping tablets, like ridiculous amounts, as we discussed, I was at risk of having a seizure. So I couldn't get into the opiate detox that I needed to get into, because they don't take you in if there's benzodiazepine in your system. So then I was told I'd need to do a double detox, but there wasn't going to be a bed available for a couple of months. So I remember them telling me that, and I was nearly angry, saying, look, I'm actually trying to do the right thing here, and there's no bed available. So I done a detox at home on my own, and my younger brother was minding me within that. And I described that home detox off benzos as not only the most painful night of my life, it was the most important night of my life, because I ended up having a grand mal convulsive seizure. I split my tongue down the middle, horrific physical experience, landed in hospital believing I was brain damaged because I could not make sense or label the room. And there was a moment in Blanchardstown Hospital where I thought I was brain damaged, and I just had this realization, or this sort of thought process, I can't do this anymore. I can't fight this anymore. You win, I'm done. Between the anxiety, the drugs, the brain damage, I give up. And I remember lying back down on the hospital trolley, just waiting to be overwhelmed by panic and anxiety. But this sense of peace came over me, something I had never experienced. And this was a fundamental moment in my life, because I didn't have the language at the time. But that was the first time in my life I stopped fighting my inner narrative. I stopped fighting anxiety. I stopped resisting reality. It was a moment of surrender that I truly believed changed my worldview and how I looked at the world. And after that moment, like, I was so physically, mentally and emotionally broken, I wasn't making sense of it in the moment, but there was a knowing inside of me that I will never do drugs again. It was like the lights came on. I was like, what have you been doing? An awareness came into me, like, very hard to describe.
It's one thing to say I'll never do it again, but yeah, there's always the next day. So how did you actually progress?
Yeah, I 3 weeks lying on my couch after that. It was the most difficult experience in my life, was the aftermath of that seizure. I was obviously going through benzo withdrawals as well. I had another couple of seizures and hospital visits, but I could barely hold a phone in my hand. I remember at the stage I had to ring, it was something to the job, to keep me job. I still thought I was trying to keep me job at this stage through the union. And I had to go and see their doctor and make a phone call, and I couldn't even squeeze the phone in my hand. Like, I was that broken mentally, physically at that stage as well. But I was just advised, just go to a detox, forget about everything. And I ended up 3 weeks later, the benzos were in my system, and I went for a 6 week stint on a farm on the outskirts of Dublin, this detox centre. And there was everything was taken off me, no phones, didn't have to worry about getting drugs, didn't have to worry about paying for drugs, didn't have to worry about me debts for 6 weeks.
And did you have the craving though?
I didn't have the craving. It was something had shifted. It was really bizarre. It's really bizarre. The craving wasn't there. There was only one moment while I was in detox, because I was still taking methadone. I still had to be on methadone at this stage. And it's not that there wasn't a craving there. It was like I knew this road just didn't work anymore. But there was one moment when I was in the latter stages, down to about 3 or 4 mils, because they wean you down off methadone from 100 mils down to 3 or 4 mils. And there was a time when I just couldn't sleep for days on end. I think you have micro sleeps within that. But there was a night in there where I was in the kitchen, just walking around circles in the kitchen, listening to the clock. It was like it was in slow motion, tick tock, tick tock. And they used to put the knives away every night in a safe. And I didn't really put it together. I didn't realise why. But I remember in the room that night, I was like, oh, that's why they put the knives away every night, because people would turn on themselves. I felt like I'd nowhere to go. And there was a moment that night in detox that if there was drugs there, I would have most certainly taken them 100%. It's difficult to know what my mindset was at the time, because it was so scrambled. But I was so fearful of my emotions. We were on this little in this house in the back ass of nowhere, basically, in Dublin. And I was afraid of the dark. Like, I was afraid of everything. Like, my emotional world was just all over the place. So I couldn't leave the kitchen. I was just trapped in the middle of the night. And that was the only moment I remember where I would have done anything to get drugs, because the essence of addiction is escaping pain. And I just wanted to escape that pain. But I got through those nights, I got through those moments, and I have never had a craving since, which is an incredible thing to say.
So at the end of the 6 weeks on the farm, Brian, how did things go from there?
Well, so basically, I thought you go to detox and you go back unleashed into the world. I didn't know what way it worked, but apparently that's just the start. You go to a treatment centre then. So I arranged to go to a treatment centre down in Wexford. It was a place called Asheree. So with another 6 weeks in a treatment centre in Asheree. And really there, you work on yourself and you look at the fundamental reasons underpinning your addiction. But something had happened to me. Like when I was in that detox facility, something happened to me, and I wish I could bottle it up and give it to people, but it was like the world was in 3D. It's very hard to describe. It was like I felt so alive, so present, so energized that something had shifted and the world just felt so exciting to me. So when I went down to the treatment centre in Asheree, they were more used to people being broken and afraid and stuff like that. But I was like this bundle of energy that just wanted to explode into the world. So it was a difficult 6 weeks. I just wanted to get out into the world. I was introduced to not so much academia. I was introduced to psychology and Eastern philosophy, and I was obsessed. You could nearly say I switched addictions. And I think that was the core element of my recovery, that I found something new that I was obsessed about. And this was the human mind. And I was eating books, even in detox. I got down to Asheree in treatment and I wanted more books, books, books. I wanted to learn. I wanted to read.
Did you go back then to live with your family, knowing and being aware that there were addiction issues there? I mean, and arguably that might have been a danger zone for you.
I went back, and I don't want to, we laugh about this. I went back to my brother's house, and the first night I got there, they were both in a sense of addiction themselves. One of them was certainly in the depths of addiction. So it was a very interesting introduction. But I actually felt sorry for them. I felt, I wish I could give this to them, whatever I had. I'd no want, no urge. I was so excited about my new life.
Which led you back into studies and getting a degree and getting a doctorate ultimately.
Yeah, and to be fair as well, like I struggled personally myself. I didn't feel like I struggled, but mentally I was struggling with social interactions. I was sort of unaware that I was struggling, and that sort of helped me to an extent as well. Like people still thought, says he's a bit crazy, like we're worried about him. So it took me a bit of time. I went and done a degree in psychology, and I started designing what I called a program for life to help me to master my internal and external world. And it worked. I got a PhD. Lots of incredible things have come into my life. I mastered my relationship with anxiety. I have a great relationship with anxiety today. And I start teaching what I learned through my lived experience with other people. My whole business model today, I go around to the core, into the workplace, prisons, schools, teaching my lived experience and my academic expertise and that program to life to other people. And that's what lights me up today. That's what gives me the joy.
You come to terms with the anxiety. I mean, do you get the occasional surge of it? And if you do, how do you deal with it?
I enjoy anxiety. That's a crazy thing to say. And I'm not saying I enjoy the feelings of anxiety. I enjoy my ability to swat it away when it comes. Like I done the convention centre there last year with 2,000 people in it, and I knew I'd get anxious before stage. But through breathwork techniques, I can regulate my emotions. I can regulate my heart rate, which is the core biological component of anxiety. So instead of the belief being I can't cope with anxiety, which led to drugs, my belief today is I'm going to take my toolbox out and swat it away. And that's why I have a great relationship with it. And there'll be other elements of that. Like I exercise, I move. People often say like exercise is great for mental health and anxiety. I don't think that's completely true. I think a sedentary lifestyle can cause anxiety and depression because we evolve to move, forage and hunt. So movement, connection, breath work, decision making framework that aligns with what's important rather than making these feelings based decisions that pull you off course. So I've lots of strategies and lifestyle ways of living that help.
I was looking actually at a recording on YouTube of a talk that you gave at the Pendulum Summit. I think that's what you were talking about. And I was struck by something you said. It stuck with me since, and I thought it was very interesting where you said, look, you know, you talk about you might come home at the end of a week and you'd be had a terrible time and you say, oh God, I need a drink of wine or a glass of wine or a bottle of wine or whatever. And then you drew on this idea that one of the rowing coaches of the British team in the Olympics came up with, does this make the boat go faster?
Yeah.
And you measure everything you might or be thinking about doing against that because it brings values into it as opposed to feeling.
Yeah, and I think this is really critical for people to think, especially in the world we live in today. There's so many temptations, whether it's alcohol, whether it's technology, whether it's foods. Like, they have the best scientists in the world hijacking our reward systems of our brain, pulling us away. And it's this idea of feelings-based decisions versus values-based decisions, doing what's right, not what's easy. So if you value your health and you feel stressed, are you going to have a bottle of wine or two? That's a feelings-based decision. Are you going to make a values-based decision and go for a run, call a friend? If you value a relationship, but you have to have a difficult conversation, are you going to avoid that because it's uncomfortable? Feelings-based decision. Or are you going to act on your value of that relationship, honesty and respect, and have that difficult conversation? And there's so many areas of life, like we might be bored. Do you pick up your phone or do you call a friend? So we've got to be aware of the temptations and our want. Like, our brains do not care about us being happy. Doesn't give a crap. Our brains want to experience pleasure and avoid pain. And that's a fundamental self-preservation survival mechanism. And we're always looking for that pleasure. The reward system is being hijacked by the modern world. So we need to, more than ever, be aware of what we value, what is important to us, so we can make choices that align with that, rather than being pulled off course by our emotions. And will it make the boat go faster creates a metaphor for that. Will this make my boat go faster? And you can hook whatever's important to you onto that metaphorical boat.
Addictions cover a range of things: drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, cigarettes. I suppose you'd say phones at this stage. Food, you mentioned as well. Now, you describe yourself as an ex-addict. You don't hear people talking about being ex-alcoholics.
No, it's I call myself recovered. And it can be quite challenging for some people as well that are in recovery, because they feel that you have to say you're in recovery, so you're always on red alert. The reason why I say I'm recovered or an ex-addict is that, like, I've nothing to run away from anymore. Anxiety was the driver. We need to get under the bonnet. What is driving the addiction? It's not about the behaviour or the drug or the substance. That's just a symptom of the problem. The problem is underneath that. For me, it was anxiety and panic attacks. I don't struggle with anxiety. I actually enjoy anxiety to an extent today. So I've nothing to escape or avoid. So I think fundamentally what people have to do is look at what is underneath the bonnet. What is driving that addictive behavior? It could be a lack of connection, could be rejection as children and abandonment. It could be a lack of purpose in your life. There's something else going on that makes you want to escape. And I think that's where, like, poverty and challenging situations, environmental and societal situations come. Like, for some people today, if their lives are so tragic and unmanageable, that reality is so painful, well, why wouldn't you be an addict? Like, you might as well be in the depths of addiction, rather than, it could be a better reality than what you're living in. So I think, again, it's a societal issue that we have to get to the bottom of, whether it's around poverty and these challenges
that's
going on.
Yeah, but Brian, how does one get through to somebody who is addicted to something? How do you make that intervention? Or is it not just a question of letting events take their course, as happened in your own situation, where you lost your job, you hit that brick wall?
The answer is just very little you can do, and that's the unfortunate thing. Now, talking on the documentary, I was working with Professor Anna Lemke from Stanford University. She is, for me, the foremost expert in addiction when it comes to applied as well as the science behind it as well. And we had a great conversation where we were sort of talking about, we've got to facilitate safe consequences. And what that means is, I was sort of enabled by my work colleagues many, many years ago. I should have gotten sacked a long time before I got sacked. That would have been facilitating a safe consequence. So imagine somebody at home, let's say the husband or the wife or a family member is getting drunk all the time, blind drunk, and they're sleeping on the floor. Well, don't help them to bed in their stupor of drunkenness and they wake up in the morning and they think it's not that bad. Let them wake up on the floor. Leave them in the garden if they go sleep in the garden. Facilitate safe consequences. And obviously, if it's -2, you don't leave them in the garden. Safe consequences being that it's not going to kill them. Somebody in addiction has got to see the pain that they're causing them to give them that potential wake-up call. But not everyone has it. And one other thing as well, Dr. Gabor Mate talks about this as well, because I call it passive, that you can open up a space just to listen to people and say, look, if you want to chat, I'm here to chat. Never try to fix or tell them what to do, because the addiction will defend itself aggressively if it needs to. But if you can open up a space and say, look, if you want to talk, I'm here if you want to talk, and listen compassionately to understand. Gabor Mate calls that compassionate inquiry, and it's really powerful.
You and other experts, and in fact we hear politicians raising the question most recently, the Taoiseach Simon Harris, as to whether that the social media should be off limits to kids under 16 years of age. Now, I mean, is smartphone addiction as dangerous as substance abuse in your view?
I think it's nearly more dangerous because it's so insidious. One of the trickiest addictions to break away from is smoking, because the consequences are so far down the line. And it's the same with phones. They are hardwiring. They are changing the neurochemistry of our brains. Professor Anna Lemke calls it the modern day hypodermic needle. And I think that's a really powerful, powerful way of saying
it. Is that not a bit alarmist though, Brian? I mean, for instance, when I was a kid in the 60s, television had just arrived and, you know, oh, you get addicted to the box in the corner. You know, it's all consuming and family's lifestyle had completely changed. Is this not just a latter day version of that?
Well, I'll give you a couple of things on that. So since the front facing smartphone came into effect in 2012, suicide rates for young girls has doubled. So that's quite alarming. That is very, very alarming. Up to 25% of kids at 6 years of age have access to a phone. 6 years of age. Their brain hasn't even began to develop. And there's something I heard recently that really struck me as well, that there's only two industries in the world that call their customers users: the drug industry and the tech industry. Like, they want you to consume. And kids are spending up to 6 hours on average a day on their phones. That's problematic in itself in terms of rewiring your brain, having no attention span, no focus, massive issues with mental health challenges, which could lead to all sorts of challenges. But what are they not doing in those 6 hours that we done? They're not playing. They're not learning how to debate, how to argue, how to be happy, how to communicate. All of these key human skills.
And of course, they can be got at by way of bullying and all sorts of things.
All sorts of other things as well. So I think it's highly alarming, and it's more alarming that lots of people don't see it's alarming. I think that's quite
tricky. So what do you say to parents? Because they're under pressure from the kids to get them the smartphone and to have access all areas.
Yeah, my 11-year-old stepdaughter at the moment, she doesn't have a phone and all her friends do, and they're calling her Nokia Blockia at the moment, and there's a lot of pressure on. And what do you actually do? I think the first thing parents need to do is get off the phones themselves, because I still struggle. I find myself hiding my phone and my stepdaughter when she comes into the room, and I wouldn't have a struggle with the phone per se. It's more for work, but I still want to check that phone, and I consider myself to have bulletproof mental health, and the phone's still grabbing me. It's a powerful lure. Like, we have the best computer scientists in the world collaborating with neuroscientists to hijack our brains. That's what they're trying to do. Like, a capitalist society wants a world full of addicts at the end of the day, consuming, whether it's food, whether it's technology. So parents have got to get off the phones themselves, but that is really, really difficult.
It's one thing to say no to an 11 or a 12 year old, but you need as well, presumably, to give them the skills to deal with the slagging they get.
That's it as well. And the genie is out of bottle with the phones. Like, the phones are there. I think we can stop kids having them in schools and stuff like that. But maybe, like, I remember me stepdaughter Ruby, she came down and she was learning rivers and mountains in England and stuff like that. And Natalie, my partner, was saying, oh, wait, she has to learn this. And I says, does she really? She'll get them on the internet at any time. Maybe we should teach her how to be happy, how to regulate emotions. Maybe they should have programs in schools how to use phones in an effective and healthy way. I think that's something that should be in the schools. I think we're gone past the day of memorising geography stuff and history stuff. It's important, but we don't need to rote learn this stuff and spend hours and hours. Like, the Leaving Cert is a rote learning machine. Spend that time giving us skills of how to communicate, how to be happy. Happiness is a skill. I've crafted the skill. I'm an extremely happy person today. That's the skill.
What are the values that you live by now?
I've about 12 or 13 values. My three core values: number one is health, because everything is downstream from health. Number two is relationships, and the relationships I have in the world, the connection I have. And number three is my inner peace. Now, lots of other things, continual learning, boldness, I like to be bold, clarity. There's multiple different things that come into that as well. But I live by those three core values. And I suppose purpose-driven stuff, like I woke up recently a couple of weeks ago and I had two jobs. Like I have my business today where I deliver workshops and talks for the corporate world. But I do prisons and desk skills for free. And I woke up a couple of weeks ago and I scanned my brain, what's on today? And I did a talk in Mountjoy Prison and Weefield Prison. And I just felt this energy inside of me, just this spark inside of me. Oh, brilliant. I'm really looking forward to today. And it gave me an insight into, I suppose, my purpose and what is valuable, what is important to me. And I suppose it's teaching people that are giving people opportunities that also struggle in similar ways to myself. Like, it was a miracle I didn't end up in Mountjoy. I sold drugs for years. So what we're trying to do at the moment is we're working with Indeed.ie to go into the prisons for people that have 6 months or less left under a prison service and get them jobs for when they walk out. Imagine the ripple effect of that on their families and society. So this is the thing, I suppose. I don't know what you'd call that as a value. It's just giving back.
Why do you believe that the idea that addiction is purely a disease or a moral failure, that that's off the mark?
So I think the moral failure is really, really off the mark, that you're just weak of mind. Like, I would take any person that is strong of mind and believes that and make their reality so painful that they would be screaming to escape it. Like, you take the Dalai Lama, put him into Guantanamo Bay for a year under intense pressure. He will want to escape that reality. And if you gave him drugs, maybe he would take that. So really a moral fail, and it's environmental. That's the reality of it. So taking the biological model, there's definitely some biological factors, but it's far from the whole situation. It's really environmental and societal, because again, if you grow up in an area where drugs are normalised, alcohol is normalised, you don't know any different. But then all of a sudden, your basic needs aren't being met. Like, just like food and water, we need them biologically to survive. We need connection. We need safety. We need security. And if you haven't got that security and you haven't got that safety, your nervous system will be ramped up. It will feel anxious. It will feel agitated. Our brains don't want to feel like that. It wants to escape and avoid that stuff, avoid that pain. And if you have an outlet of drugs or drink, of course you're going to take it, especially as a young person. So it's inevitable. It's actually inevitable in some people, in some situations, that they will take drugs. So definitely not a moral failing. Biology plays a small role, but environment is the key.
What about free will, though?
Well, that's free will. Determinism, does it exist? I think there are, I'm back and forth on this argument. I used to be a big determinist, very much from the Skinnerian school of thought. But I think free will to an extent, like, did I have free will? Have I made a choice about my addiction? I'm very grateful. Like, I wrote a book and call it Bonus Time because I'm so grateful I got a second chance at life. I'm living on bonus time. But did I have free will? I don't think so. My parents, who struggled with their own addictions and caused me a lot of anxiety, they were incredible when I found recovery. They gave me the foundations. My whole family gave me the foundations to recover. When I found the entry point of recovery, there was a psychologist in the centre that sort of nurtured me to go towards academic pursuits. Dr. Johanna Ivers, who was in the documentary with RTE, she came in to do a brain study. I thought it was brain damaged at the time, and she wanted me to be part of the brain study. She made an off-the-cuff statement, God, you have a sharp mind. And I thought, maybe I can go to college if she thinks of a sharp mind. 5 years later, she gives me a job teaching in Trinity College. Crazy things come into my life. None of it was free will. There was a lot of deterministic stuff.
Well, there was a decision taken that you want to make the best of whatever chance or opportunities life threw up for you.
Yeah, there's a great line in my old gym. It was, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And opportunities came, I prepared, I worked really, really hard. But I'm very aware of my family and my surroundings and the support I got.
Were you able to pull members of your family along with you in working through addiction?
100%. Like, there's a great line in addiction that it's not a spectator sport. Eventually the whole family get to play, but recovery is the same as well. Like, my mum and dad don't drink anymore. My sister was in the depths of addiction with alcohol. She doesn't drink anymore. She's sober. And my brother was in bad addiction with cocaine and weed and alcohol. He's 5 years clean now as well. So it's been incredible for the whole family. There's just been great recovery for all of us. And we're so connected and so happy today. Like it's amazing. It's a bit of a miracle, to be quite honest.
It's a wonderful note, I think, on which to end. Congratulations on all your achievements. Dr. Brian Penny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was episode 15 in this series. To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including pioneer of Irish media and former RTE producer Leela Doolan discussing her resignation from the organisation and her passion for activism. Psychologist and death doula Laura Coleman on The Last Taboo, conversations around dying and how to have a good death. Social media star and breast cancer survivor Georgie Crawford on the real cost of surrogacy. And you'll find out too why I'm now one of her followers. And remember, if you hit the follow button on your preferred platform, you'll be alerted when a new episode becomes available.